So today, talking about moving, we've been doing this thing about uncluttering the soul and kind of just movement from generally a negative thing to a positive thing. And I spoke a while back about isolation to connection back in July, and today I'm going to talk about pessimism to optimism. Now, frankly, I'm just not feeling very good about this sermon. I don't think it's going to go very well. But okay, a few people picked up on that. Come on. It's not that early. So back in July, I did that, and I mentioned that I have this negativity streak. My friend and coworker Jack over here, he kind of shares that. So I mentioned that to him, and he said, you know, I should probably come listen to that. So just say hi to Jack before he leaves. Catch him. Don't let him go. And I'm glad you're here. So anyway, you know, I do have this kind of negative streak, and I know that when I mentioned that in July, that was quite a shock to a lot of you. Obviously I'm kidding. So, you know, but yeah, I do come by it honestly. My father was quite the pessimist. I'd kind of put him on a scale of 1 to 10. I'd put him and me in the day about a 7 or an 8, not extreme. He had quite the lovable side. He was a wonderful man, but he did have a pessimist streak in him. And so this week I met with Jeff Good, our pastor, and said, Jeff, where would you put me on this scale of 1 to 10? And he said, oh, you know, I'd put you at a 5. Well, Jeff is such an optimistic guy. He said, okay, that puts me at least a 6. I mean, come on, let's get real. But when I thought about it, I thought, you know, 5's pretty good. 5's like right in the middle between the extremes. And I'll bet you Jesus was a 5. That is my, I'll bet he was a 5. So, and I'm actually going to say that later on. So I'm going to explore that. And when I say pessimism to optimism, that kind of implies that being an optimist is the right way to be. And I will just tell you right now that I do not believe that. And I will kind of unwrap that as we go along. I think pessimists and optimists both have some movement to make. I'm just curious, if you think of yourself as a pessimist, I'm just curious, raise your hand. Okay, get real. There's more of you out there. Okay. How about optimists? Who thinks you're an optimist? Yeah, Bob's kidding himself. No, I'm just teasing you. Okay, so that's all good. You know what? Pessimists, they like to say, hey, I'm just a realist, right? I'm not a pessimist, I'm just a realist. Come on. Now, an optimist, they have this notion, hey, I can change reality with my optimism, power of positive thinking. Well, all that is, and I actually kind of mean this, I haven't read the book written in the 50s, I think, but I think it's just psychological manipulation. You can change your perception of reality, but reality is reality, and you're not going to change it by being negative or positive, frankly. But the bottom line is everybody thinks they have a clear view of reality. They think they have a right view of reality. Our pride demands that we think we're right. And so we need to open that up. And the question we want to answer is, on what is your view of reality based? And what truths or lack thereof with today's relativism are you basing your reality? And the Bible gives a very clear-eyed view of reality if we choose to believe it. And like I said, I think everybody has some movement to make, and I'll come back to that. So let's first define. Let's do some definitions. What is optimism? What is pessimism? First, what it is not. Optimism is not a cheerful personality. It's not cheerfulness. It's not a bubbly personality. Likewise, pessimism is not being grumpy. It's not grumpiness. It's not being a curmudgeon, which I kind of think of myself as a little bit of a curmudgeon. I have a coworker who calls himself a cheerful curmudgeon. There you go. And basically, those are personality traits, personality dispositions that are either fed or starved by this positive or negative outlook that we choose to adopt. So I looked up dictionary.com. The dictionary is a fabulous resource, and I'm not kidding. For any Bible study, you need to have a dictionary, whether it's online or hard copy, whatever it is. It's a great resource. I looked up pessimism, optimism. There's three definitions of each, very complementary or contradictory to one another. So let's look at those first. Pessimism, the first definition was, pessimism is the tendency to see, anticipate, or emphasize only bad or undesirable outcomes, results, conditions, problems, etc. Optimism, on the other hand, is a disposition or tendency to look on the more favorable side of events or conditions and to expect the most favorable outcome. Now, frankly, I admire the optimist crowd. I'm not one of them, but I admire optimists because I know enough that negativity pulls people down. I experience that almost every day at work with a couple of folks, one in particular, and looking on the bright side is just a happier way to live. My problem is with this phrase, expect the most favorable outcome. And the realist in me, and I mean the realist, I look at that and I'm sorry, the most favorable outcome is a hit or miss deal. Life has its ups and its downs. And the optimist has to overlook a lot of disappointments. That's fine. So, second definition. Pessimism is the doctrine that the existing world is the worst of all possible worlds, or that all things naturally tend to evil. Optimism is the doctrine that the existing world is the best of all possible worlds. All I'll say there is both of those are pretty unbalanced for different reasons. Let's move on. We're not the best, we're not the worst. I mean, anyway. Third, pessimism is the belief that evil and pain in the world are not compensated for by goodness and happiness. Whereas optimism is the belief that goodness ultimately predominates over evil in the world. So here you have the people, you're holding the scales and you have the two little pans on the scales and you put the weights on one and it tips one way or the other. And this is, this view is one side outweighs the other. The good always outweighs the bad, or the bad always outweighs the good. Okay. Now, there was a fourth definition of optimism which, at least on dictionary.com, did not have a counter definition for pessimism, and that is this. Optimism is the belief that goodness pervades reality. Goodness pervades reality. It spreads throughout reality. I think that is fascinating. Christians, we know that this is true. We know that goodness does indeed pervade reality because we serve a loving, redeeming God who does pervade our reality. And reality, whether it's our reality or not, He does pervade reality. We know that to be true. But we also, as Christians, know the evil in our own hearts. We also know our natural bents. That's what drove us to the cross. That's what drove us to Jesus to seek His forgiveness in the first place. So my problem is with the optimists who look somewhere else for that goodness that pervades reality. If it's not from God, where do they think that goodness comes from? So I thought perhaps they look at nature. Nature, the force of nature. Well, we know that that's simply false because God created nature. It's His created thing. It's not a force in and of itself. Another one that I'll unpack more is kind of, people say they believe in God. They don't even know what that means. They think of God as just this benevolent, perhaps distant, either a force or an abstraction or an old guy that's very far away. And the most important thing to them is this: as long as God is love. Because love is everything. We need to give love a chance. Well, in concert with that, they reject any idea of judgment. They reject any idea of a wrathful God. And they say, well, that's just contradictory to my belief that God is love. He can't be love and be the judge at the same time. Those two just can't go together. Love is preeminent, that's it. Well, the problem is you cannot have, let me put it a different way. Without judgment, there is no hatred of evil. And without hatred of evil, there is no love. If you do not hate the destructive consequences that sin and that evil brings upon those you love, then you're not loving them. You can't have love without judgment, because if there is no love, if there is no judgment, then there is an ambivalence towards evil. There's an indifference to evil, and there is no love if God cannot be love if he is indifferent to the evil that impacts our lives. Why does God hate sin? Because he knows how harmful it is to us. He knows the destruction it causes in our lives, and a loving God must judge or he cannot be love. Therefore, those who demand that God is love and stop there, they have to stop there, because if they don't stop there, then they're kind of opening themselves up to the judgment of themselves, because they know they're guilty. We're all guilty. Everybody knows they're not perfect, right? And therefore, if you say God is more than, if he's judgment and love, then you're opening yourself up to this judgment, and they don't want to do that. So just know, God is love, and that's the goodness. Well, it's just there's nothing there. That's a goodness that is just going to fall down. It's not going to hold up. So that idea of that goodness pervading reality just won't work out in reality. So the other source that people might look to for goodness is then humanity itself. We look to one another, and this speaks to a common belief that people are basically good, that we are, you know, we're born good, and it's outside forces. It's external things that bring corruption into the human heart. They see beauty in the human heart, and they think if we can just move aside economic barriers or racial barriers or some other whatever societal barriers there are, then that goodness of the human heart can rise up and flourish and pervade reality. But what this optimist fails to recognize is the corruption that took over that beautiful human heart when God was rejected. Yes, there is beauty in the human heart. There is. And it does show up, because we are made in the image of God. But that beauty has been corrupted. It's been taken over by a rejection of God. And the reality is, we all start. Each of us are born in this state of rejection of God. We all begin with a willing separation from God. That is where our heart starts. It starts in a corrupted state. And the Bible paints a pretty clear picture of this, of the human heart in this state of separation or rejection of God. And Jeremiah 17:9 says, "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it?" And then Paul cites several Psalms, Proverbs, as well as Jeremiah and Isaiah, and he puts these all together in Romans chapter 3, starting in verse 9. "What then? Are we Jews any better off? No, not at all. For we have already charged, established, that all, both Jews and Greeks," that's Bible terminology for everybody, "Jews and Greeks are under sin, as it is written, none is righteous, no, not one. No one understands. No one seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they have become worthless. No one does good, not even one. Their throat is an open grave. They use their tongues to deceive. The venom of asps is under their lips. Their mouth is full of curses and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. In their paths are ruin and misery. And the way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God in their eyes." This isn't somebody else. This is us. If and when we were in a state of separation from God. Thankfully, this is not the end of the story, but there is clearly no pervasive goodness to be found in this biblical true description of the human heart. And so ironically, I said this isn't the end of the story. Ironically, the goodness of God that does pervade was best found in an agonizing death on the cross, surrounded by the hatred of those he was dying to save. Romans 5:8, God shows his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. That is the goodness of the God that no one seeks in this description we just read. So where does an optimist who is looking in all the wrong places need to change? Perhaps that's you today. You need to humble yourself. You need to confess the evil that is in your heart. And you need to submit to the goodness of Jesus that is made available to you by a living and loving Savior. So, let's talk about pessimism. My problem with pessimism is my problem with myself. Because if I hold that there is no goodness that pervades reality, then I'm remaining in a state of rejecting God. I'm remaining in this state where I'm denying God's goodness and his power. I'm denying the light that can penetrate the darkness. And so that needs to change, obviously, because we need to open our eyes to the goodness of God and recognize that. So back to the beginning, I said, you know, we're going to move pessimism to optimism, but I understand it's semantics, but I'm saying optimism is what I just described, and I reject that for the reasons I described. And of course, we must reject the pessimism view as well. So it may be semantics. I'll grant you that, you optimists who want to use that word. I'm fine with that. But I'm going to choose a different term that I'm just going to go with, which is positive realism. It's realism because it understands who we really are, or who we at least really were. And it understands the way the world is, that there is a prince of the power of the air, our enemy. And then it's not based on our opinions and on our feelings. So there is a realism there, but it is pervaded by positive, because how can it be anything but positive if you've recognized the grace of God that has overcome death, that has defeated sin and death? How can we have anything but a positive view? How can there be anything else? So positive realism speaks more to the heart of what I think we ought to be. Again, if you want to call it semantics, fine, but I think you get the point. How can we be anything but positive when we have a sure and lasting hope in spite of who we are or who we once were before the Lord came and redeemed us? Hebrews 11:1 says, now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. So I'm being gradually shaped by a pervasive, persistent, and unquenchable goodness of God. Jesus shows up in my life over and over again. He is in my day-to-day life, and he's there in my ups and my downs. You know, Romans 28 says, very familiar verse, God works everything for good for those who are called according to his purpose. But if you've heard me speak before, you know that goodness is not a happy circumstances goodness. It's not, oh, everything's just going to work out okay. It's much deeper than that. It is a joy that is deep-rooted and rises far above any of the happy or unhappy circumstances that we might experience. So that's what the goodness of God is driving us to. So in my struggle with pessimism towards positive realism, Jesus is the game changer. Jesus is the goodness that pervades reality. Hebrews 4 says, since then, we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who is in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. And it is that mercy and grace that make us positive realists. So let's look at Ecclesiastes a little bit. Jeff mentioned Ecclesiastes last week, and at first glance, Ecclesiastes is a pessimist dream. It is just awesome. And especially, you think about it, it's written by Solomon. God bestowed on Solomon a measure of wisdom far beyond that of any other human. And Solomon pursued wisdom and self-indulgence and pleasure and wisdom and toil or work, and even pursued despair. He chased all these things, and when he was done, he wrote this book, and he starts off with this. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanities. So the word vanity isn't just a shallow, you know, pride thing. It's an emptiness. It's something transitory. It's unsatisfying. It's altogether vain and meaningless. So I stick with the English Standard Version, but I will say the New International Version, NIV, starts off with a much more vivid wording of this, so I'm going to read that. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. So there is no optimism here. He doesn't start out with a rosy outlook. He's not going for the Mr. Cheerful title. It kind of sounds like he's going for a way extreme opposite of that. But, you know, stick to the end of the story, right? So he continues, though, to unwrap what this meaninglessness is and how he came to that statement. In chapter 1, verse 12, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. And then in verse 2, it doesn't quite lighten up yet. In verse 2, he starts to tick off all the things that he gave himself to. I'm just going to, not putting them up on the screen, but just ticking them off quickly. Verse 2:1, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Verse 3, I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine. Verse 4, I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. Verse 6, I made pools from which to water the forest and grow trees. Verse 7, I bought servants, slaves, frankly. I gathered for myself silver and gold. Verse 8, I got singers and concubines, women. Verse 9, I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Verse 10, I kept my heart from no pleasure. Verse 12, I turned to consider wisdom and madness. Verse 20, I turned about and gave my heart to despair. What is the common denominator of all these descriptions? I said, I searched, I made, I bought, I kept, I turned. Everything he did was out of his own efforts and out of his own resources, and everything he did left him unsatisfied and frustrated. So then he gives it all a whirl, and he wakes up in verse 24. Now there is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil or work. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner, he is given the business of gathering and collecting only to give to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. So I was at Myrtle Beach a couple of weeks ago, and you know, it almost doesn't, the first day was just too hot, but even hot days typically on a beach are fine because you have that wonderful ocean breeze going up and down the beach. And some days there, it was even a gale. And then it was interesting, when you walked off the beach, you'd get about 20, 30 yards off the beach, and there would just be no wind at all. And all of a sudden, the sweat all of a sudden would just magically appear. You know, the wind, it comes and it goes. Can you catch the wind in your hand? Can you control the wind? It is a hopeless endeavor. And all these things that Solomon tried were this hopeless endeavor. They were like striving after wind. And to sum it up, life left to our own devices, separated from God, is a striving after wind. And yet, there is a different picture that Solomon concludes with. It is not a pessimistic view. I would say it is a positive, realist view. In verses 24 and 26, there is satisfied contentment. Enjoy your work. Enjoy your days. There is a joy and a knowledge and a wisdom and a peace. And he repeats that enjoy, eat, drink, and enjoy your toil. He repeats that again in Ecclesiastes 3:12, again in 3:22, again in 5:18. Four times at least he comes to that phrase. That is as the wisest man who ever lived, aside from Jesus, that is his wise conclusion. And so he closes the book. There's a lot more in chapters 3 through 11. But in verse 12, he finishes, next to last verse, is just this: the end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. This keeping the commandments is not a burden, it is a joy. He gives us commands that free us from the evil consequences that he hates, and opens us up to his love and his goodness. I think this is best summarized. The Westminster Shorter Catechism begins with this: the chief end of man is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. The chief end of man is to enjoy God and to glorify God and enjoy him forever. That was Solomon's conclusion. So it is left for us. The whole duty of man is to enjoy this embrace of God. We are his children if we have chosen to receive Jesus, to believe in his name. Enjoy today for today. You know, I wasn't going to mention Shelley, but she's not here, and even if she was, she wouldn't mind. She, on May 31st, when she got her diagnosis, and those few days after that, God brought this reality home to her. And you could see it that very next Sunday she was here. She is enjoying today for today in a way that we just, until we're faced with our mortality, we just can't do that very well. Jonathan Edwards had, I think it was 21 propositions, and he would read these over and over again. And I didn't look them up for this, but a few of those were to focus on his mortality, to focus on the fact that his days are numbered, so that he would keep his eyes on Jesus, which is forever. And that is, you know, we need to do that. Enjoy today for today. Enjoy your spouse. Enjoy your children. Enjoy your friends. Enjoy one another. Enjoy your work. Maybe you need another job. I don't know. I hope not. But, just seek the Lord in your work and enjoy your work and enjoy your pleasure and be thankful for all these things to God. It is impossible to be negative about something that you're thanking God for. If you are thankful for what God has brought into your life, it's a lot harder to be negative about those things because your eyes are on the Lord. So Solomon was no optimist, but he was no pessimist either. And I would just say, I kind of like the phrase, positive realist. There's an enjoyment to be found in the Lord. So back to me. Let's get the attention back to me. I always like to say that. Am I a positive realist? Well, the answer is yes. But Carol might tell you, my kids might tell you, my Jack might tell you, several of you, most of you would probably tell me, judged by your laughing at me at the start, that there's still this negative streak that's there. And why is that negative streak still there? Well, that's pretty easy. Because I take my eyes off of Jesus. I forget his sovereignty. I forget his goodness. I forget to be thankful. Sometimes I choose not to be thankful. I fail to trust him. And the only natural course of that, at least for me, is to go negative. So there's an example from one of my kids. I have six kids, and it could be any of the six. I'm not going to name names, but they gave me a pretty good example of the negative side here. So we are planning a trip to Great Falls. We were going to go with some friends, and we were talking about this. This was, you know, a date in the future. It wasn't going to be that day or anything, and one of my kids, and it doesn't matter how long ago it was, one of my kids was just, I don't want to do that. He hadn't been to Great Falls. He didn't even remember what the park was. Yeah, they're looking at each other. Who's he talking about? So, you know, he's all down in the dumps. I said, why are you being so negative? He said, you guys are always making me do things I don't want to do. I said, that doesn't faze me after six kids, believe me. I just kind of go, okay. So you know what? You're just not trusting me and mom, all right? He said, exactly. Sometimes I don't trust you and mom at all. And that is exactly, and I mean that is exactly what I do to God. I look at God and I say, I don't trust you at all. And then I remember, just as this kid remembered, I remember the gospel, and I remember his grace, and I remember the history of my life with the Lord, and then things can turn around. And then light comes back in, and it penetrates the darkness, and then negativity is set aside with this positivity, because God is there in the middle of it, and his goodness pervades reality. So I expect God's goodness to pervade the course of our nation. I expect God's sovereignty and goodness to pervade the weekly news. I expect God's goodness to pervade my work days and yours. I expect God's goodness to pervade my halting attempts at parenting. I expect God's goodness to pervade the futures of my children. I expect God's goodness to pervade my failing health as I grow older. And I expect to see his goodness and his glory when I get to see him face to face. Every negative thought will be gone. So when my mind is right, when your mind is right, that's positive realism. So let's pray. Father, thank you. You are so good. You are so, so good. And Lord, you know how much I have doubted that at times. You know how much I've told you, are you really there? Are you really good? I've known in my mind that you are, but in my heart, I'm crying out, no, you're not. Or I wish I could see it more. But Lord, your goodness has never left. And it's always there. And it does pervade every bit of us. It pervades every bit of our reality. Father, help us to see it. Help us to turn our focus back to you. Help us to turn our focus to Jesus, who is the gospel, who is your grace and mercy towards us, who made the way. Lord, help us to keep our eyes on him. And forgive us, forgive me for those times when I look at you and I just say I don't trust you. Thank you that you're patient with me and with each of us. Thank you for your goodness. In Jesus' name, amen.